is pushing to undo decades of reform of the of policing, of the prison industrial complex in the state. More people getting locked up, more people being criminalized, less ways to afford to live in this city, in this country.
Jordan, before we go, I'm just interrupting because we have less than a minute. Talk about the prisoners, people held in the parish jails, what they faced at that time, often just awaiting trial, stuck in the dark, in the filth.
Right. We're talking about many people who had just been arrested a day or two before for some minor charge like public drunkenness. The city jail before Katrina was the largest city jail in the country. 7,000 people being held there. The New Orleans police were arresting 60,000 people every year. That's in a city of less than 500,000 people. Do the math on that. You had 95% of those arrested were arrested for nonviolent offenses. When the floodwaters were rising, people were left to die. When they finally were rescued, they were shipped to maximum security prisons around the state, like Angola State Prison. Many people were lost in the system for months. I remember nearly a year later, advocates found a woman who had been lost in the system. She didn't
Jordan,
even know
I'm afraid we're
going
to have to leave it there, but we will continue covering the 20-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina tomorrow. Thanks so much for joining us. Jordan Flaherty, New Orleans-based independent journalist and film producer, author of Floodlines. Thanks so much for joining us. More of our coverage tomorrow.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations of programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the first Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive is here. Help us reach our $45,000 goal. Sign up to support us during this critical time for community media, now through September 20th. All you have to do is check out kboo.fm/give. Text KBOO to the number 44321 or mail us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue and support Radical Radio together.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the 12th Annual Montevilla Jazz Festival, celebrating Portland jazz in a three-day village-style festival, August 29th through 31st, with local artists across 26 concerts in five venues in and around East Portland's Montevilla neighborhood. Info and jazz adventure passes at montevillajazz.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Kotek tees up a second attempt at an ambitious transportation package for the state, Multnomah County is getting ready for DEI and ICE challenges, and how hot and dry has our summer really been so far? This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 28, 2025. Good evening, I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Governor Tina Kotek proposes a tax on electric vehicles and hybrid cars to fill some potholes in her transportation bill. KBOO's Hannah Francis has more with reporting from Josh Salem.
Oregon transportation accounts for our highest production of carbon emissions. Electric vehicles, or EVs, were seen as one potential solution for that climactic problem. To encourage their use, Oregonians across the state have been able to purchase an electric vehicle at a lower price because of federal and state rebates and amounts up to $15,000. Now, a new proposal under Governor Tina Kotek's transportation bill would require EV and plug-in hybrid drivers to enroll in a program that would charge them a per-mile fee, or a road use charge, for driving in any Oregon thoroughfare. The state says it needs the charge to fill a $300 million Department of Transportation budget gap. That gap in part has arisen because more people have been buying EVs, following which they stopped paying the state's 40 cent per gallon gas tax. That tax supports road maintenance. Environmental groups say that the governor's proposal could deter people from driving these vehicles and might significantly slow down emissions reductions. Oregon already had a voluntary road use charge in place called OREGO. Under that program, participants pay 2 cents per each mile they drive, with monies collected going into road and bridge maintenance. The rate was calculated to match what the driver of a gas-powered vehicle that gets 20 miles per gallon would pay in gas taxes. The gas tax did provide the funding necessary to keep up with road maintenance for many years, but the problem is gas-powered cars have become more energy efficient and now get more miles per gallon. Less gas sold means less taxes collected. And there are more electric vehicles on the road than ever, with more than 117,000 electric or plug-in hybrid vehicles being registered in the state of Oregon. Under the proposal, which legislators will consider in a special session tomorrow, electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles would be required to sign up for the OREGO program. The 2 cents per mile driving charge would remain the same. If the proposal becomes law, the state's registered vehicles would not all have to sign up immediately. It would require current EV owners to sign up for the program when they renew their registration after early 2027. Then, new EV owners will be required to sign up for the program starting in January of 2028. Hybrid electric and plug-in hybrid electric vehicles would be phased in beginning of July of 2028. Environmental and climate advocates say that the current proposal is flawed. Under Kotek's proposal, EV and plug-in hybrid drivers in the program would still pay nearly $200 more per year than the driver of a car that gets 20 miles per gallon because of the road use charge. A road usage charge fee could convince people not to buy or lease EVs, compounded by the fact that the Trump administration is ending federal EV tax credits. Oregon is also running out of funding for rebates. On Monday, legislators held the first public hearing for Kotek's proposed bill. Hundreds of people submitted testimony. Public support for the road use charge appeared limited. Some commented on the high number of vehicles here with Washington license plates. Those cars, of course, would not pay road use charges for the miles they drive in Oregon. Brett Morgan, transportation policy director with the nonprofit advocacy group Climate Solutions, said, quote, "The road use charge is a really good user pay model. But if we start out with just penalizing EVs, we're sending all the wrong signals about what we should be doing as a state," end quote. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Hannah Francis.
From DEI to ICE raids to homelessness, Multnomah County Commissioners Megan Moyer and Shannon Singleton announced some updates this afternoon on major issues impacting Oregon's largest county. First, here's Megan Moyer and then Shannon Singleton.
I wanted to take the opportunity to reconfirm Multnomah County's continued commitment to DEI. We earlier got a message at the end of last week from our chief operating officer related to the process that the county is going through. It is my understanding that, and is my expectation and my understanding, that we will not, in fact, in any way roll back our DEI programming. It is a review to be in full legal compliance with all pre-existing civil rights law so that if we are in court, we are airtight, that we have followed precedent and the language of the past laws of the United States of America. And so I just wanted the public to hear from the board the continued commitment. And I say this not just because I believe in diversity, equity, and inclusion, but it is essential in order for Multnomah County to accomplish what is our mission, which is often to provide the most critical safety net programs to our most vulnerable, our seniors, our people with disabilities, children, public health, health clinics, the range of services that Multnomah County provides. It is essential that if we do not take an equity lens, we will leave people behind and they will not get equitable access to treatment. And so I just want to reaffirm my commitment, the county's commitment, that we are doing this work intentionally. I think I'm not alone on the board, that we'll just watch it closely and make sure that it's going to result how we expect it to be, which is the tightening up of our language to provide the best possible defense for our continued commitment to DEI.
Commissioner Moyer, I could not agree more. I had a joint town hall with Senator Lisa Reynolds and Council President Pirtle Guinea at Cathedral Park. So just wanted to appreciate all the community members who showed up and hearing about some of the priorities, which continue to be CEI Hub. And also we talked a lot about some of the needed changes around addictions recovery. And I think it's really critical. I hope we'll have some conversations about it in the coming months. We absolutely need to stop exiting folks from deflection or sobering and having them go back to the streets. And I think it's really critical that we find opportunities for folks to actually enter recovery when they are ready for that, because it's not often that people are ready. And if we miss that opportunity, we're setting them up for failure to try and be clean and sober while they're still sleeping outside. The state legislature is in special session right now around transportation funding. They are still keeping the 50-30-20 split that we know is critical to help fund the transportation needs of the county. I just wanted to uplift as well. I think it's critical that they follow through on their commitment to the Black community and the Rose Quarter Improvement Project. These decades of unkept promises just cannot continue. And I have shared some testimony with leadership and the Joint Transportation Committee imploring them to keep their commitment to the Black community on this project. Last night, my staff and I took a very formative training called Migra Watch to support our community in the face of likely ICE raids. We met so many other folks there. It was a packed building, learned a lot, and definitely helped me feel like there's a lot of people in our community who want to make sure that our community members are kept safe. I will be happy to share that. There was an encouragement to share the training with friends and colleagues. I think it's really critical that we know how to make sure that folks aren't kidnapped off the streets of Portland. And I want to appreciate the organizers, ACLU, Together Coalition, and Portland Immigrants' Rights Coalition for putting this training together. They're doing it periodically in the community. But also want to name that there was a specific ask from a community member about safer spaces for people who might be from the immigrant community. And they do have those opportunities. And so just want to say out loud that folks were encouraged, if they want to set up some culturally specific trainings in safer settings, they can do that and work with that group as well. Quick update on this from the homeless response system. We met last Friday. We appointed 3 new CAC members, so Community Advisory Committee members. Additionally, we talked through some proposed key performance indicators. We have some of our current indicators expire at the end of this year. Commissioner Moyer, we've talked some about the need to do a deeper dive on some of the behavioral health key performance indicators. But I wanted to share with my fellow commissioners that the KPIs that are being discussed there really line up well with what we've all discussed as part of the supportive housing services key performance indicators, and really those goals of keeping homelessness rare, brief, and non-recurring. We have some good ways to start measuring not only how are we getting folks out of homelessness, but what is that inflow and how are we capturing when folks are falling into homelessness. But I just wanted to appreciate everybody who participated. There's some really low-hanging fruit work that we can do as the county to better support people getting out of our anti-poverty programs and into some of these living wage jobs.
And that was Multnomah County Commissioner Shannon Singleton today. We've had a dry summer with some heat waves and wildfires that are still burning. So how has it measured up so far, and what can we expect next? For insight on that, we check in with Larry O'Neill. He is the state climatologist for Oregon and Oregon State University.
This summer has been really dry, and we've seen a lot of increases in drought severity and extent. And a good way to look at that is the U.S. Drought Monitor change since mid-June. At that time, about 48% of the Pacific Northwest was in some form of drought, and the most severe form was D2 or severe drought, which covered about 12% of the Pacific Northwest, and then a little bit of D3 that was creeping up into western Montana. Fast forward 2 months, and currently 81% of Pacific Northwest is in some form of drought. And this includes the most severe places. We have extreme drought in the North Washington Cascades And then in the northern Idaho panhandle and into western Montana, the southern part of Oregon is currently free from any abnormally dry conditions, which is a welcome change from the last several years. We've also had a lot of drought declarations that have been made by each state and county within Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Seven counties in Oregon and two in Idaho have approved drought declarations. And then the large swath of Washington, including the Cascades and into eastern Washington, and parts of the Olympic Peninsula have a drought emergency declaration. And then a large swath of areas around the Puget Sound, including Seattle, Tacoma, and Olympia, have a drought advisory currently. And we're starting to see some really adverse impacts from that across the Pacific Northwest, unfortunately. So how did we find ourselves into this situation? Essentially, it's a lack of precipitation since early April that has driven a lot of the drought severity. And over the last 90 days, most of the Pacific Northwest, we've had less than 30 to 50% of normal precipitation for that time. So conditions have been really dry. When you look at the state precipitation rankings for the period between April and July, when the latest statistics were available, Oregon has received its fourth driest period in that time, Washington its third driest, and Idaho its seventh driest. So overall, it's been a very dry end of the spring and start to the summer. Once we start to look at the calendar year for 2025, things don't look so bad. We're in the middle. We're still accruing precipitation deficits in Idaho, Montana, and Washington, but it's about normal for this year. And that kind of shows that the relatively wet winter that we had. We also had this atmospheric river event in mid-August about a week or two ago. And we did get some really beneficial rain from that throughout Western Oregon and Washington, especially Washington. We have some localized amounts of 6 to 10 inches in the Olympic Peninsula and then in North Oregon or North Washington Cascade range. So the core of the atmospheric river kind of hits Washington and Vancouver, but it was not quite enough to end the really severe drought conditions in a lot of Pacific Northwest, unfortunately. It was also quite warm for the last 90 days. And across most of the Pacific Northwest, we had a much warmer than normal start to the summer. And when you look at the state temperature rankings, surprisingly, Oregon and Washington experienced one of the warmest June through Julys on record. So fourth warmest in Washington and sixth warmest in Oregon and 13th warmest in Idaho. And so this has pushed our calendar year temperature rankings to much warmer than normal. And this is offsetting the really cool start to the year that the Pacific Northwest experienced. So these warmer temperatures did drive one of the things we worry about with excessive temperatures and drought is how it contributes to evaporation, especially during the spring and summer. And to measure that, we use what's called an evaporative drought demand index, or the EDDI. And this just measures how much above or below normal evaporation was from the landscape. And so how much is the atmosphere sucking out of the soil and fuels across the state? And we had more evaporation than normal. So we had more water being sucked out of the landscape. This was a really contributing factor to the drought formation, especially in Western Oregon and also in Eastern Washington, Northeast Oregon, and the Idaho Peninsula. Excessive evaporation has definitely contributed to our droughts. And in all three states, we've had a majority of the stream flow gauges have been below normal throughout the last 45 days. The worst state is in Washington, where going into that atmospheric river event in the middle of August, about 75% of the stream flow gauges were below normal. And while that mid-August atmospheric river precipitation event was beneficial, it did not end the drought or the wildfire season.
And that was Oregon State climatologist Larry O'Neill. The tragedy at a Minneapolis school and church has led to renewed calls about prevention. And some say society needs to lay the groundwork in spotting warning signs much sooner than it currently does. Mike Moen has a story.
As Minnesotans mourn those killed in Wednesday's mass shooting, public frustration is mounting over the frequency of these attacks in the U.S. Local researchers recommend a comprehensive and compassionate way of spotting warning signs and responding to them. The deadly attack on students at a Minneapolis Catholic school has again brought gun violence back in the spotlight. At Minnesota's Hamline University, James Densley is with the Violence Prevention Project Research Center. His team's recent findings say those who carry out school shootings are often in a noticeable crisis, meaning students, staff, and parents should be trained to recognize concerning behavior and how to report it.
So a lot of this is really around communication, that people trust in the systems that are going to get people off of that pathway to violence so that they don't go looking for answers in the darkest corners of the internet.
He says speaking up shouldn't lead to punishment for the person in question, but rather accessible and affordable forms of care. The center also says mass shooters have significant trauma histories, and researchers recommend a more thorough screening of childhood trauma as kids grow up. Densley acknowledges challenges, such as peers not wanting to be seen as snitches for reporting someone. Densley and his colleagues say these recommendations complement detection systems already in place or other often discussed solutions, including safe storage of firearms. He says it can't just be about preparing for a situation where a person in crisis no longer cares whether they live or die and are willing to kill others in their final act.
And that is very hard from a deterrent standpoint to figure out how we go about preventing this through usual security apparatus. And instead, we really have to get more upstream of these problems because these are shootings that are rooted in despair.
Densley says they've interviewed people who've carried out mass shootings along with those who had their attack plans thwarted. For situations where tragedy was avoided, he says there was a common factor that served as a blockade.
Many times it was a human intervention. It was an act of kindness that gave them hope and a reason to live. And it may sound simplistic, but time and time again, it was that human connection that really made the difference.
As for warning signs in someone they know, he says people should be mindful of dramatic changes in behavior that include aggression or an unexpected flurry of social media posts centered around grievances. This is Mike Bowen for Minnesota News Connection.
Cancer researchers in Washington state say they're already feeling the impacts of federal cuts to their work, and the Trump administration is proposing deeper cuts next year. As Isabel Charlet reports, experts warn the cuts could stall progress in treatment and impair the next generation of cancer researchers.
Federal cancer research that has fueled life-saving treatments in Washington state and across the country is facing a major financial hit. The Trump administration's 2026 budget proposal calls for slashing the National Cancer Institute funding by nearly $2.7 billion and cutting the National Institutes of Health by more than 40%. Dr. Daniel Lin, professor at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center at the University of Washington, says cuts are already affecting the university's research.
One of the big ways that we are feeling the cuts is it's simply become more competitive to receive these grants. In history, there are usually grants that perhaps 1 in 10 get funded, but that is down now to 4% or 3%.
Lin adds grants focusing on disparities in cancer rates and aggressiveness across racial and socioeconomic groups. In other words, anything that could be labeled DEI have been specifically targeted for cuts. Lin says he is worried about losing young scientists who would carry on the legacy of cancer research. He adds, without stable funding, the pipeline that develops future innovators is at risk.
These young investigators have tight timelines. They're on 2-, 3-, 4-year timelines to generate research to propel them to the next level. And that, to me, is one of the most threatening aspects of cut.
The NIH's National Cancer Institute, the world's largest cancer research funder, used federal dollars to help drive a 33% overall drop in U.S. cancer deaths from 1991 to 2021. Lin says treatments today have progressed so far that many are unrecognizable even from 10 years ago.
And those have come directly from research at universities such as the University of Washington and across the country. Where would we be if we didn't have that research?
Lin says universities will be turning to other sources of funding like private foundations to fill in the holes left by the federal government. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
A school shooting once again brings calls to address gun violence. Indiana protesters also call for the state to not get involved in the national redistricting fight. For more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2025 Talks.
Don't just say this is about thoughts and prayers right now. These kids were literally praying. It was the first week of school. They were in a church.
Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey is calling for ways to limit gun violence that go beyond thoughts and prayers after a gunman opened fire at a Catholic school while students and teachers celebrated Mass. Two children were killed in the gunfire and 17 others were wounded. The gunman died at the scene but left messages on rifle magazines, including one saying, "Kill Donald Trump." FBI Director Kash Patel confirmed the gunman identified as transgender. The man who assassinated Democratic Minnesota lawmakers in June cited a hatred of transgender individuals on social media. Hundreds of Hoosiers protested against redistricting at the Indiana State Capitol Tuesday. Some Republican officials say they're reluctant to get into a gerrymandering arms race, although others, including the state's attorney general, say it's necessary because they accuse other states of artificially inflating their census numbers. Democratic Congressman Andre Carson, who represents Indianapolis, is scathing.
I think what we're seeing is an assault on our democracy. My hope is that my Republican friends, most of them don't want this.
Numerous states seem to be considering redrawing their maps, but so far, only Texas has done it, and California has started to. At the urging of President Donald Trump, Texas Republicans passed new congressional districts that could potentially give them 5 more congressional seats. California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom called for a special election in November for maps to counter those. In Iowa, a Democratic state Senate candidate in a Trump-leaning district near Sioux City clinched a surprise victory Tuesday. The win breaks the Republican supermajority in the state legislature, meaning certain appointments and laws can't be passed on a party-line vote. A new poll also finds that the majority of voters disapprove of President Donald Trump's takeover of policing in Washington, D.C. Nearly 60% of voters disapprove, although responses largely split on party lines. According to the New York Times, the investigation into Trump National Security Advisor turned critic, John Bolton, is focused on his mishandling of classified emails. The Times reports that Bolton may have shared documents in an unsecured way, letting a foreign power get access to them. The Times is also reporting that the director of the CDC has been fired after clashing with DHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. over vaccine policy. Susan Menares had been on the job about a month. At least 3 top officials at the CDC have resigned over what they're calling the weaponizing of public health. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
With August congressional recess drawing to an end, people are making sure their elected representatives know what they think, especially about H.R. 1, also known as the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, before they head back to Washington, D.C. and resume work after Labor Day. Eric Galatis reports.
Colorado Representative Gabe Evans, one of 4 House Republicans to vote for the GOP's signature tax and spending bill, recently met with local business leaders. The measure cuts Medicaid, food assistance programs, and clean energy investments to help pay for Trump administration priorities, including mass deportations and tax cuts. Kelly Nordini with Conservation Colorado says H.R. 1 is one of the most anti-consumer bills in some time.
It's going to have Colorado families paying higher utility bills, breathing dirtier air, and really bearing the cost of tax breaks for billionaires and big oil.
Nordini points to the recent scrapping of plans to build a battery factory in Brighton in the 8th District, which Evans represents, as a direct result of H.R. 1's rollback of solar and wind incentives. The law also increases fossil fuel industry subsidies above the current $757 billion per year. President Donald Trump campaigned on promises to ramp up oil and gas production and to end clean energy investments that he claims amount to the federal government picking industry winners and losers. Nordini says Trump also campaigned on lowering prices, but she notes the loss of wind and solar capacity, which is the fastest and cheapest way to get energy onto the grid, will lead to even higher utility rates for consumers and businesses.
By gutting and really saying everything but clean energy, the Republican budget bill threatens here in Colorado 9,600 clean energy jobs over just the next 5 years.
H.R. 1 is also expected to create a $1 billion hole in Colorado's state budget. Nordini believes members of Congress need to hear directly from the people they represent about how their work impacts their daily lives.
What does rising utility bills mean to them? What does impacts on their health care coverage mean to them? What does it mean when we have a harder time cleaning up the air in Colorado, their kids' asthma? It's important for members of Congress to hear that.
This is Eric Galatis.
A second chance for people who serve their time. Here's Antonia with National Native News.
Today, we're featuring the Northern Arapaho Reentry Program, which is helping people return home from out-of-state prisons and state incarceration to the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming.
People who are going into prison and have nothing, and so this document will be deterred.
Terry Smith moves around boxes in her office filled with blankets and other supplies. She's the program's administrator. Smith is a former Northern Arapaho tribal attorney and judge who went through a public downfall, being indicted on drug charges in 2019.
But during that time, I was dealing with a lot of grief and loss that I had no idea how to cope with, and so I became addicted to opiates.
Due to the pandemic, Smith was out on bond, but eventually went to federal prison, serving 6 months and 6 months on an ankle monitor. Smith says helping clients in the reentry program is a dream job.
Just gone through the process myself, being charged, being in treatment, being on probation, I feel like I connect on a deeper level with all my clients.
Smith works with people before they even get out of prison for a smooth transition. She helps look for housing, transportation, jobs, and benefits. This day, Smith is driving clients around to appointments, including checking on GED classes.
I just love seeing people get their life back.
Clients Leah Littlefon Whiteplume and Anthony Big Medicine say Smith and the reentry program have been a lifeline.
Some of the challenges that I faced was like trying to get a job. I didn't have any clothes or shoes when I first got out because what I had was the clothes on my back and that was it.
She helped me get my driver's license, something I never thought I'd actually do. She always there when I need it. She told me from when I first started working with her, she said, I'll help you. We also put in the effort too. You work super hard, she'll do her best, whatever she can for you.
The program's voluntary and open to tribal citizens enrolled in one of the two tribes of the Wind River Reservation, the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone. It's also open to tribal descendants who are not enrolled in either tribe and other Native American tribal members. Many in the program say they have faced ups and downs, but are more determined now to stay out of the justice system with the program's assistance, like clients Thunder Little Thunder and Dolan Nido.
I know that I could do this with the help of Terry's programs. Amazing. What she does is inspiring. I love her support, how she advocates for us and helps us with the right resources and gets us going on our feet.
When I got out of prison, I was trying to do it all myself, and I realized how hard that was. I think for somebody that's actually getting out of prison and trying to get back on their feet and trying to do the right thing and not just go back into the criminal mentality that they were in, I feel that this program is very helpful.
Substance misuse is among struggles clients say they have faced, which often led to crimes they were sent to prison for. The tribal reentry program requires sobriety, says Smith.
I'm very loud and proud about my recovery, and I had a really public downfall, so I feel like it's my responsibility to show people that we can get better.
And that's the choice clients like Serena Perea have made.
I have three children. They're